Did you ever question why judges sit in panels, especially at the highest levels in the high courts and the Supreme Court? Or why you and I as a citizen can just walk into any random court and attend judicial proceedings there? Or even why dissenting opinions are included in the judgments, because dissents per se don't carry any practical value? So these questions won't even strike our minds, despite most of our work revolving around the courts. And see, courts are one of the oldest government institutions. Courts have been in existence for as long as governments have, and when anything exists for this long and simultaneously, if their practices are still in vogue, it means these practices, these traditions are so important and crucial for them to run. And they have been this important and crucial for thousands of years, because if they're not, we would have just abandoned these practices. So a lot of practices in courts are not just empty practices. There are reasons why they're in place, and there are reasons why opinions of judges and judgments are delivered in a particular order, or why in a panel of judges, all the judges give their opinions. And the answers to all these questions are very interesting and they're very insightful. So we'll appreciate the sort of influence and impressions these factors have on all of us. And I have read upon all these things that I've mentioned before, so have a hearing to find out. You're listening to Hamlet of Law, a legal podcast where we discuss judgments of Indian courts, the laws, policies, and the history behind these laws and policies, and everything official to judicial. This is your host Naren Rudra, and this is the second episode of Hamlet of Law. And in this episode, we'll discuss why courts conduct the proceedings in the way they do, and also why the judgments are written the way they are. Yeah, we'll just focus on these two issues, that's it. So to have a deeper understanding on these issues, we have to start with the history of courts and understand how and why courts were even established in the first place. So if we go back to the time where we didn't have formal social government institutions like the legislative, like the judiciary and all, if a crime was committed, it would be tried by the head of the state, and that is the monarch. And the monarch would try the accused in public courtrooms, and almost always the monarch would be assisted by these individuals that are proficient and informed on relevant issues. And this group of advisors was called a council. Now, the reason why the council would provide assistance to the king was not just because of their experience. It was primarily to avoid any error in judgment, because there is a possibility that the king might descend into a fit of rage after getting to know the facts of the case, or he might be favoring some party because of their background or because of their relation with the king, or for a host of other things. But with the council assisting the king all the time, the council would mitigate in some way or form all the rage or all the errors, and would reject all the subjective criteria, and the council would help the king deliver judgments reasonably. And in addition to that, having multiple members would also prevent favoritism or corruption or delivering biased judgments, because the possibility of all judges being biased or all judges doling out favors would be very little. And also, judges too are not free from having their own ideological leanings. And the lawmakers or the king's side identified this and tried to rectify this. So if the judges were to decide something that could easily go either way, or when the issues are very nuanced, judges could very easily give in to their leanings. So to stave off all these inevitable factors that have the potential to derail justice, the cases are decided by multiple judges so that all the judges could discuss and hash out the objections and arrive at an objective and fair conclusion. And this is exactly the reason why even now, the highest courts are often presided by a panel of judges in almost all the countries. Because at the highest levels of the country, judges have a lot of impact, and the judgments become laws, and countries can't afford to go wrong when the repercussions are this wide and the stakes are this high. On the same note, the Supreme Court, for the first time in 70 years, allowed for a single judge bench to hear certain bail appeals and a few of the other cases so that it can dispose of cases quickly and efficiently. Now, back to the topic. So kings always wanted to expand their territories because they were kings. And for that, they had to be at the helm and manage a lot of activities. And also with more and more territories being acquired, the activities of the monarch too started to increase. So they had little to no time to try these cases and to attend to the judicial functions. So they delegated their judicial work to an entity called, surprise, surprise, the courts. And they gave these courts all the judicial powers, like the power to punish, impose penalty, or call for evidence, and all the powers the current day courts have. But nonetheless, they reserved the power to overrule the decisions of the courts, because they were kings and they can do whatever they want to. So this delegation of judicial power also explains a historical idea and also a general perception on the courts, that they are just an extension of a king. So they should just interpret and enforce laws made by the king. And this is where their work ends. So they can't nullify or change or read into laws any new doctrines, because the courts themselves derive the power from the king and the laws are again made by the king. So how can courts go against the very authority from which they source their power from? And we'll discuss a little bit more about this in the later segments of the podcast. Now, if we take a look at India, close to 3,000 years ago during the Mauryan rule, courts were presided by three judicial members and three ministers, presumably to balance the interest of justice and the interest of state. And also, another interesting thing here is, the laws then mandated the king to dress modestly during judicial proceedings so that the litigants wouldn't be intimidated or flustered by the king's presence. Yeah, it's a very ingenious thing, right? Yeah, on the other hand, if you look at the British history, after the famous Norman conquest in 1066, the Norman didn't stop there. They went on to conquer and unify surrounding territories. And in these newly acquired territories, cases were obviously being decided according to their local respective customs. So, to maintain uniformity in laws across all of the territories they acquired, a king's court was established. And this king's court was somewhat similar to this current day Supreme Court, because it was the highest court of the land and it had a lot of discretionary power on how judicial proceedings can be conducted in all of these territories. And one novelty about the king's court was it decided cases with the help of judgments given by courts in actual controversies. This is a little peculiar because normally laws would already be in place describing what is an offense. And if someone commits that offense, they would be tried in the courts under that law, right? So, but that's not how the king's court started off. So after forming this king's court, it started adjudicating all the cases in all the territories under one single law that is common to everyone in that territory, and thus the name common law. And again, as a step forward to unifying all the laws in the territories, Henry II ordered a panel of judges to travel across all the territories, which was divided into circuits, and ordered them to deliver judgments publicly so that one same bench would unify laws across all the territories they travel on. And this bench was also ordered to adjudicate similar cases in similar ways, because they knew that each decision would make a new law and each interpretation would serve as a legal precedent for deciding future cases. Now, we're digressing a little bit here, but it's fun to know that after the Norman conquest, one of the ways how people used to resolve disputes was the accused would be forced to pick a red hot bar of iron, probably from a furnace, or he was forced to pluck a stone out of a cauldron of boiling water, or something equally painful and dangerous, and then they would wait for 3 days to check whether the injury was healed or not. And if the injury didn't heal, it was believed that God knew that he was guilty, so he didn't heal the injury within 3 days. And if the injury was healed within 3 days, it was thought, see, God knows that he is innocent, so the God has already healed him. And this system was junked by William II, and he established proper courts even for the smallest of offenses. And in Britain, since the Norman conquest until now, that is for almost 1,000 years, each individual judge of a panel would orally deliver his judgment in public. And again, in public, because to the people and to the society, this type of public delivery appeared to be an honest, transparent, and a very accountable system. Because judges used to discuss publicly, and them publicly discussing among themselves and inquiring the parties appeared to impute this belief that judges are independent and they are not influenced externally. So they are free from the clutches of the aristocrats or someone who's closely associated with the government or with people in power. So everyone could attend trials and witness how it's going on and decide for themselves how fair the trial is. So this sort of open judicial proceedings also would inculcate the idea that our judiciary is fair and transparent and it has always got our backs. So there would be some sort of assurance or some sort of social security from the judiciary too. So as I said before, all the judges would give their individual opinions so that opinions can be attributed to each judge. So since all the judges would deliver their opinion in series, this type of judgment delivery is called seriatim system, with seriatim meaning series. And this type of seriatim system is still existent in a lot of countries, including India. Now, I didn't find how judgments in India were written before the colonial influence. And if you do find it, please tweet it at Hamlet of Law or comment on an Instagram post of this episode. And if you're watching it on YouTube, just write it down in the comment section below. And it was after this establishment of the King's Court and after this type of justice delivery system with a panel of judges, a professional bar was established. And as a result of this, the cases started getting reported. And these reports included arguments presented by the courts, the opinions of all the judges, and a few miscellaneous things. Here too, everything was being recorded either by the parties to the cases or the advocates involved or the law reporters. And often these reports would be incomplete or would be recorded by multiple people. So cross-checking and verifying it with other material you find was the only way to certify the veracity of the judgment. But more often than not, the judgments used to be recorded accurately. So it was these recorded cases that were being used as an authority on the subject and also as precedents. So these materials helped the court to deliver judgments consistently. So this seriatim system was still in vogue until 1756, when William Murray, also known as Lord Mansfield, was made the Lord Chief Justice of the King's Bench. And he did not like the way the courts delivered judgments and found multiple issues with the seriatim system. So by the time Lord Mansfield became the Chief Justice, Industrial Revolution was making its way and the courts were delivering judgments with multiple opinions. So understanding the judgment or its ratio was very cumbersome because readers had to note down how many judges are there in the panel, and then they have to record how many were for or against an issue, and then they have to read all the opinions. So naturally, with time, these opinions started becoming more and more nuanced and complicated. And as a result of this, using judgments as precedents for future arguments started becoming even more cumbersome and inconvenient. And back in the day, judges used to reserve judgments for a lot of time. So all these things rendered judiciary and getting involved with the courts to resolve a dispute in very unappealing and time-consuming and counterproductive. So further, Mansfield believed that rules should be understood by people who are to obey them, and he thought these type of judgments were way too complex and thought it would get even more complicated because with the industrial boom in England, a lot of contracts and transfers and promises grew in number and they became increasingly more intricate and nuanced. So the judgments too were proportionally becoming equally complex, and with multiple opinions on these already complex judgments would become virtually unreadable. At the same time, Lord Mansfield also believed that UK courts must assist the development of industries, and UK courts must also be a resort in international commercial disputes. And for that, he understood that the courts must have the best practices among all the courts, with a set of fair principles, with fast, simple, and efficient disposal of cases. And the judgments also must be clear, uniform, and consistent. And since judges back then were paid by the case, he also wanted more litigants to come to the courts. And he understood that the complexity in judgments are holding them back, at least to an extent. And to attract more litigants, he wanted the court to deliver judgments by bringing more clarity and lucidity. So accordingly, Chief Justice Lord Mansfield, he being the one who calls the shots, brought forth this rule where only a single opinion of the court with no public dissent could be published. And this opinion of the court was anonymous and unanimous. In this system, judges would discuss the outcome in private, and in cases of any disagreements, they would take a vote, and the opinion of the majority of judges would become the judgment, and there would be no dissents. So essentially, judgments had just one opinion, one reason, and only one conclusion with zero dissents. Now here too, instead of delivering the judgments with judges' names attached to it, the court would simply call it the judgment of the court. And this change was not without any criticism, but this change actually drew a lot of litigants to the courts, and judgments actually became simpler and easier to understand. But these reforms were short-lived, because after Mansfield's retirement, Lord Kenyon, the next Chief Justice, ended this practice and he retrieved the seriatim system. But the influence made a mark, because Lord Mansfield was Chief Justice for over 30 years, and 30 years is a long time. So the structure of the courts in the UK underwent a lot of change, but the judges in a lot of judgments still used to deliver the opinion of the court, especially in commercial cases. Now, these are just the courts in the UK. Now, UK is a parliamentary form of government, so the courts cannot strike down laws made by the parliament. And their highest court was something called a Privy Council, which comprised of parliamentarians, especially the upper house. And as the name suggests, this council was privy to all the decisions of the crown, and it would advise the crown on all issues. Now, this Privy Council had a judicial branch called the Judicial Committee of Privy Council, and this body would advise exclusively on judicial issues. And as opposed to other courts in England, the advice, the opinion or the judgment of this Privy Council would be unanimous, because there were three reasons. One, because their opinions were just advices to the crown, and it was believed that the monarch shall not be put in an awkward position where they have to choose between two alternatives. And two, the Privy Council delivering opinions in one voice would appear more legitimate to the people in general. And three, since these judgments were basically the laws of the land, it would be easy and simple for, quote unquote, people of the colonies who might not be familiar with the workings of the metropole. Now, technically, all of these judges in the UK are tendering an advice to the king or to the queen. So they would say, I would allow the appeal or I would dismiss the appeal. And in the UK, the judges still use these phrases, because the head of the government in the UK is Queen Elizabeth. So judges are technically advising her. On the other hand, in the UK, India, and in India and the US, the judges just say the case is dismissed, or the case is allowed, or the appeal is allowed. Now, on the same note, judges in the House of Lords were called Law Lords, and these Law Lords became the United Kingdom Supreme Court judges. And these Law Lords were allowed to dissent, because it was their parliamentary right to speak up in the parliament, but the dissents would not be published and revealed, because it would be considered as breach of privilege. But just the fact that there was a dissent would be mentioned in the reports. So we can partially attribute the source of dissents in judgments to the parliamentary rights of the law lords to speak up whenever they want to. On the other hand, if you look at France, which was another colonial superpower, and this is the reason why it's also a permanent member in the United States Security Council. So in France, dissenting judgments wasn't even allowed, because it was thought that judicial body spoke for the king, who was called the Roi de Justice. And since there's just one king, he could only exercise one will, so he will only have one voice, so no dissents. And if we go all the way to the west, to the United States, even they started with seriatim judgments because of the colonial influence of the British. And after it became independent, the Supreme Court has been delivering both seriatim and opinion of the court type of judgments since its establishment in 1790. And as the name suggests, the country was United States, and since it was a union of consenting states, some states were reluctant to follow the orders of the new Supreme Court for a host of reasons. So, the Supreme Court was then seen as the weakest of three organs, weakest of judiciary, executive, and legislative. Now, again, enter C.J. Marshall, Chief Justice Marshall. So Justice Marshall became Chief Justice in 1801, and he understood that Supreme Court was not seen as entity with any authority, power or legitimacy, and thought that the way it delivers the judgments has something to do with it. And he thought that seriatim judgments dilute the authority of the court, and giving just an opinion of the court would send a stronger signal to the ones who need to follow the orders, and he made the court deliver only opinion of the court style of judgments. Here, he made the judges of the court discuss issue in private and then come to a common conclusion as frequently as possible. And in case none of them agreed, they simply went with a vote, and the opinion that got the most number of votes would become the opinion of the court. Neat and simple, exactly like how Lord Mansfield did in the UK. Justice Marshall was Chief Justice for 35 years. That is the longest any person has ever been as a Chief Justice to a United States Supreme Court. And under him, there were hardly any dissents. And even in the famous Marbury vs. Madison case, there was a unanimous opinion, and this was drafted by Chief Justice Marshall. So speaking of dissents, in the US and in the UK, dissents were written very apologetically and submissively, and this reflected the prevailing sentiment that public dissents are to be avoided whenever possible, unless of course justified by the public importance of the case. But now that's not the case, because dissents are becoming more and more assertive and judges started to become more and more aggressive with their dissents. Yeah, now going back to the story of the United States, there slowly concurrences too have started to show up, especially in judgments where quote-unquote judges were compelled unquote to respond by writing where the judges didn't believe with the reasoning of the majority. And even this method propounded by Chief Justice Marshall got a lot of criticism, because it was thought that justices once sought to preserve the court's institutional integrity by speaking with one voice, and then they increasingly began to value their own ideology and tried to speak that through their individual voices, through concurrences or through dissents. But irrespective of all these, since then until now, the method of judgment writing has been virtually unchanged in the United States Supreme Court. It delivers the opinion of the court, and individual judges choose whether or not to write a separate opinion, either concurring or dissenting from it. And in the United States, it is assumed that judges that speak last can exert greater influence, and therefore they can fill the gaps left by previous opinions. So opinions in the United States are drafted in seriatim, with the junior most judge giving the first opinion because he has relatively less experience. And in India, it is the opposite. It's either the Chief Justice or the senior most judge of the bench that writes the opinion first and the junior most judge last. So as of now, currently across the world, judgments are written in three ways. One, where each judge delivers each opinion, and an opinion that is endorsed by most of the judges would prevail. And this is called the seriatim system. And then the second type is where the courts just deliver the opinion of the court with no dissents or concurring opinions. Plain and simple, one opinion of the court, and that is it. And the third and final type, where the court delivers the opinion of the court and individual judges choose whether or not to write a separate opinion, either concurring or dissenting from it. And this is the US model. So if we look at the history of India, three major presidency courts, Bombay, Chennai and Calcutta, were primarily presided by Englishmen. And the court culture they had was again influenced by England's judicial culture. So the way they delivered judgments too was of England style, and England used to deliver seriatim judgments. So we can reasonably assume that the High Courts and the Supreme Court inherited the seriatim system directly from England. And our Supreme Court has evolved the way we write judgments in a small way, where if two or more judges have the same opinion, they would have their names attached to such opinion, be it dissenting or concurring, because why write two opinions when you concur with the other judge, right? So in India, all the judges in a panel agree beforehand on which judge would be writing the judgment, and such judge would circulate the draft judgment after he finishes the draft, and individual judges either choose to concur or dissent. And they can even choose to write a different concurring opinion. So, for example, in a famous income tax case, this is how the judgment started. The judgment of Chief Justice Vanchu, Justice Butchworth, Justice Ramaswamy and Justice Mitter was delivered by Justice Mitter, and Justice Hegde delivered a dissenting opinion. So these are the reasons, and this is why we have arrived at the place we are. But this also begs two different questions. The first is, why were dissents not allowed? And the second is, why were dissents even allowed? Right, because dissents by themselves don't have any value. So initially, dissents were prohibited as a matter of tradition, because in France, UK, Spain, Portugal, and all these colonial superpowers, courts were seen as an extension of the sovereign, and their work was restricted to just applying the law or advising the king, but not to come with two alternative propositions among themselves to the king to get it resolved by the king. And as a result of this, multiple opinions were explicitly prohibited. And this is the same reason why reading down laws and policies and infusing into these laws any new doctrines, how much of a fear there might be, was prohibited. Also, there's a general perception and a general belief among public that there's only one correct interpretation of law. So, single opinion judgments embody this and feed into the idea of the people that this, yes, correct, there's just one correct interpretation of law, and all the people, all the judges sitting here know this, and they're applying it, and then they're enforcing it. And it is true particularly by the highest courts of the country, because they're the highest courts of the country, and people should not look down upon, or they should not even question the authority of the highest courts of the country. So to protect their authority and reverence, they only mandated the courts to deliver unanimous judgments. Also, with unanimous judgments, there's no possibility of the public doubting the judgment of the majority, because in a panel of judges, not every judge would endorse the majority view, and similarly, not every citizen might agree with the majority's opinion. And having a dissenting opinion along with the judgment of the majority opinion, that too delivered by the same institution, wouldn't look so good for the court, because the discontent and the skepticism of the majority's judgment would be easily validated by the minority judgment. And this is precisely the reason why the Italian Constitution Court recently rejected the proposition of allowing dissents even anonymously, by noting that it presented too pluralistic a view of a constitution, and therefore it would weaken the authority of the court. And another interesting reason why certain criminal courts in the UK don't issue separate opinions is because, and I quote, "To the criminal, punishment itself is bitter enough, without the salt of favorable but impotent dissenting judgments being rubbed into the wound," unquote. So it is also believed that prohibiting dissents would not allow the judges to feed their public persona by writing more separate opinions on one consistent ideology. So if we take a look abroad, in Italian courts, judges' dissents are recorded, but they are sealed in a cover, and they are only accessible to other judges and parties, to the parties only if they want to appeal. Also, until very recently, it was a criminal offense to reveal these dissents to public in Italy, and it was also the same with Spain. And in Council d'Art, which is the highest administrative court of France, a judgment cannot even be published anonymously, because this would reveal that all the judges concur to this opinion. And in Court of Cassation, which is a Supreme Court of France, only per curiam decisions are allowed. Oh, and per curiam decisions means just the opinion of the court, one single judgment. I should have mentioned it before. And in the European Court of Justice, only one opinion is issued, but it publishes the views of the Attorney Generals. And interestingly, in German courts, only constitutional cases can be dissented. On the other hand, in Ireland, constitution cases are the only cases where the judges can dissent. So when it came to giving individual opinions of the judges, everyone knows that a group of people can never think alike. So it's practically impossible to have a single opinion on any issue. And as things get complicated, the reasoning and conclusions too get very diversified. And judges are not an exception to this, because they come from different backgrounds, they have prejudices, they have their own ideologies, and a host of other things influence their leanings. So a unanimous judgment would always be short of full approval of all the judges. And if you think about it, judges too should not compromise their opinions for the sake of unanimity. So there are three big reasons in favor of seriatim judgments or any type of judgments where the judge is allowed to give his own independent opinion. So the first one would be judicial independence, and the second one would be accountability of judges, and the third and obvious one would be avoidance of any compromise in reasoning. Now, judicial independence, because in the worst of cases, judges shouldn't give in to the pressures of other colleagues or anyone for that matter. And judges must always be free to give their own explanations or conclusions or opinions in their judgments. And on the accountability aspect, we all know that judges are very powerful. And if a judge were to, God forbid, dole out any favors, it will not be consistent with the law laid down earlier. Or if the same judge had earlier delivered an opinion on similar issue, it would prohibit such judge from acting arbitrarily or applying laws inconsistently to favor a party, because all his previous judgments would be on record and everyone would have access to them. And another reason is that if judgments were so blatant and unfair, the parliament would impeach such judge. And to do that, parliament must know which judge is delivering these opinions, right? Another reason would be a unified opinion would insulate justices from public criticism, because it allows them to hide behind a single opinion, and seriatim judgment will obviously not allow that. And also, dissents in general are important, because with a shared legal culture and widely accepted reasoning criteria among judges and established legal precedents and also the type of extensive research done, there is little room for any dissent. So dissents are in a way inevitable and ineradicable disagreements, and they only happen when a judge cannot at any cost convince himself with the reasoning of the majority. So dissents are a way of showing deep loyalty to the constitution and interpretation of laws, and there's a hope that this different theory of law, this dissent, might become the law in the future. And in new fields such as human rights, IT, space laws, and intellectual property, dissents are much more common because they don't fit into any existing frameworks. And as a result of that, judges might have wildly different opinions. Now, if we come again to India, a lot of judges in India preferred writing single opinion of the court, just like the Privy Councils. And one example, one proponent of that was former Chief Justice of India, Gajendra Gadkar, because he, in his book To the Best of My Memory, expressed his preference of seriatim system, because he, as a judge of the High Court, would often be confused by two conflicting opinions and reasons for the same conclusion. So he thought the Supreme Court should speak through a single judgment, leaving the dissenting judge to write a separate opinion if he chooses to. Now, here comes the twist. The Supreme Court judges in India said they preferred not to dissent, not because of the reasons we discussed above, that is the public perception of the court, the dilution of authority, etc. and etc. But because with this sort of docket explosion, judges had no time to write dissents. And this doesn't mean that the judges never dissent because of the workload, because they do. But all it means is that judges would often forego a few minor issues even if they don't agree with it. And this is also the reason why a lot of high courts and the Supreme Court judges often believe that two judge benches, that is the division benches, often forced a compromise between the judges. And judges would dissent only if they think that the majority opinion is too extreme, and this majority opinion would impose a bad law. And these judges too would dissent only out of the loyalty to the institutions. But if they had minor disagreements and stuff, they would agree with the other judge. And interestingly, it's the Chief Justice of India who decides which judges sit on which case. And often the Chief Justice would form benches that would mostly avoid dissents, only to preserve the collegiality of the court. So what this also means is that the Chief Justice of India can potentially determine the outcome of the cases. So these are the reasons why the judgments are written the way they are, and also why the judicial proceedings are conducted the way they are. So what do you think about the way our Supreme Court delivers judgments? Because I personally favor the United States Supreme Court style judgments, because it's easy and simple to comprehend. And also, do you think giving dissenting judgments actually weakens the authority of the Supreme Court, and would it make the Supreme Court a little less revered and respected government institution? Share your thoughts on Twitter @HamletofLaw. This is your host Naren Rudra, signing off.